Chapter 41. 99, said Isaac Bell. The mob backed away, mumbling sullenly. A trolley glided up, clanging its bell to chase men off the tracks. Bell dragged Lewis Lowe onto it. You can't get on here, the operator protested. That Jap's all wet. Bell shoved the wide mouth of the double-barreled Derringer in the trolley driver's face. No stops. Straight through to Benicia Terminal. Speeding past waiting passengers at the many stops along the way, they pulled up to the Southern Pacific ferry slip in 10 minutes. Across the mile-wide strait at Port Costa, Bell saw the Solano, the largest railway ferry boat in the world, loading a locomotive and a consist of eastbound Overland Limited Pullmans. He dragged Lowe to the stationmaster's office, identified himself, purchased statement tickets to cross the continent, and sent telegrams. The ferry crossed in 9 minutes, tied up and locked to the tracks. The locomotive pulled the front half of the train onto the apron. A switch engine pushed the rear four cars off the boat. In 10 minutes, the train was whole again and steaming out of Benicia Depot. Bell found his stateroom and handcuffed Lewis to the plumbing. As the transcontinental train sped up the Sacramento River Valley, Lewis Lowe finally spoke. Where are you taking me? Lewis, to which Tong do you belong?
I am not Tong.
Why were you trying to make it look like the Japanese blew up the magazine?
I will not talk to you.
Of course you will. You will tell me everything I want to know about what you were trying to do, why, and who gave you your orders.
You do not understand a man like me.
I will not talk, even if you torture me. That ain't my style, Bell quoted from a popular poem.
Strike one, the umpire said, Lewis Lowe shot back smugly. I read your Casey at the bat.
You've told me something already, Bell replied. You just don't know it.
What?
The tall detective fell silent. In fact, Lewis Lowe had confirmed his suspicion that he was more complicated than a run-of-the-mill Tong gangster. He did not believe that the Chinese was the spy himself, but there was more to Lowe than today's attempt at Mare Island had revealed.
You give me a great advantage, said Lowe.
How is that?
By admitting you are not man enough to torture me.
Is that the Hip Sing definition of a man?
What is Hip Sing?
You will tell me.
When the tables are turned, said Lewis Lowe, when you are my prisoner, I will torture you.
Bell stretched out on the bed and closed his eyes. His head hurt, and sheep were still turning somersaults.
I will use a chopper at first, Lowe began. A cleaver. Razor sharp. I will start with your nose.
Lewis Lowe continued to recite lurid descriptions of the horrors he would inflict on Bell until Bell began to snore. The detective opened his eyes when the train stopped in Sacramento. There was a knock at the stateroom door. Bell admitted two burly protection services agents from the Sacramento office. Take him to the baggage car, manacle him hand and foot. One of you stays with him at all times. The other sleeps. I've got a Pullman berth for you. You will never let him out of your sight. You will not distract yourself talking to the train crew. If there is a cut or a bruise on him, you will answer to me. I will look in on you regularly. We will be particularly vigilant whenever the train stops.
All the way to New York?
We have to change trains at Chicago.
Do you think his friends will try to bust him out?
Bell watched Lowe for a reaction and saw none.
Did you bring shotguns?
Auto loads, like you said. And one for you, too.
Let them try.
All right, Lewis. Off you go. Hope you enjoy being luggage for the next 5 days.
You will never make me talk.
We'll find a way, Bell promised. Luxury train tickets, a suit of wealthy English writer tweed, A gold pocket watch, expensive luggage, and $100 were all it had cost the spy to hire the defrocked J.B. Skelton to masquerade as Arnold Bennett. So reported Horace Bronson, the head of the San Francisco office, in a wire waiting for Isaac Bell in Ogden. But although threats of a long prison term had frightened him into talking freely, Skelton had no idea why he had been hired to pretend to escort so-called missionary students. He swore on a stack of Bibles, Bronson noted wryly, that he did not know why he was then paid another $100 to revert to clergy status and hold a service in the Mare Island Chapel. And he denied any knowledge of why Harold Wing and Louis Lowe tried to make it look like the Japanese blew up the Mare Island magazine to cripple ships of the Great White Fleet. Horace Bronson believed him. So did Isaac Bell. The spy was an expert at making others do his dirty work. Like Arthur Langner's big guns, he stayed miles away from the explosion. The source of the pass that Lowe had used to get his wagon aboard the ferry into the Navy Yard would have been a clue. But the paper itself had burned up in the explosion, along with the wagon and the truck. Even the mule was no help. It had been stolen in Vaca the day before. The guards, who had admitted hundreds of trucks and wagons, could not pinpoint any helpful information about the passes or the wagon load of strawberries they had allowed on the island. 2 days later, when the train was highballing across Illinois, Bell brought Louis Lowe a newspaper from Chicago. The Tong gangster lay on a fold-down cot in the dark, windowless baggage car with a wrist and ankle handcuffed to the metal frame. The PS operative guarding him was dozing on a stool. "Get yourself some coffee," Bell ordered, and when they were alone, he showed Louis the newspaper. Hot off the press. "News from Tokyo." "What do I care about Tokyo?" "The Emperor of Japan has invited America's Great White Fleet to make an official visit when it crosses the Pacific." The bland mask that Louis Lowe habitually wore on his face slipped a hair. Bell detected a minute slumping of his shoulders that broadcast an inner collapse of hope that his failed attack had still somehow provoked a clash between Japan and the United States. Bell was puzzled. Why did Louis care so? He had already been caught. He was facing prison, if not the hangman, and had lost the money he would have been paid for success. What did he care? Unless he had done it for reasons other than money. "We can assume, Louis, that His Imperial Majesty would not have invited the fleet if you had managed to blow up the Mare Island Naval Shipyard in his name." "What do I care about the Emperor of Japan?" "That is my question. Why would a Chinese Tong hatchet man try to inflame U.S.-Japanese antagonism?" "Go to hell." "And for whom? Who did you do it for, Louis?" Louis Lowe smiled mockingly. "Save your breath. Torture me. Nothing will make me talk." "We'll find a way," Bell promised. "In New York." Heavily armed Chicago Van Dorns, backed up by railroad police, transferred Louis Lowe from the Overland Limited across LaSalle Station to the 20th Century Limited. No one tried to snatch Louis or kill him, which Bell had half expected. He decided to leave him in the care of protection services until the 20th Century got to New York. And Bell continued to stay out of Lewis's sight at Grand Central, where another squad of Van Dorns put Lewis in a truck and drove him to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Lowell Falconer was on hand to smooth the way for Louis Lowe to spend his first night in a Navy brig. Bell waited for the captain on his turbine yacht. Dyname was moored to a Navy Yard pier between Hull 44's ways and a huge wooden barge attended by a seagoing tugboat. On the barge, engineers were erecting a cage mast. It was a full-scale rendition of the 12-to-1 scale model that Bell had seen in Farley Kent's design loft. High overhead, Hull 44's stern filled the blue sky. Hull plating was creeping higher up her frame, and she more and more was taking the shape of a ship. If she became half the fighting ship Falconer had envisioned and Alistair MacDonald and Arthur Langner had labored to make swift and deadly, Bell thought, then this view of the back of her was one the enemy would never see until their own ships were adrift and on fire. Falconer came aboard after he got the prisoner settled. He reported that Lewis's last words as they clanged the door shut were, "Tell Isaac Bell I will not talk." "He'll talk."
"I would not count on that," Falconer cautioned. "When I was in the Far East, Japs and Chinese virtually eviscerated captured spies. Not a peep."
The Van Dorn detective and the Navy captain stood on the foredeck as Dyname backed into the East River, her 9 propellers spinning with a smoothness that Bell still found eerie. "There is something more to Lewis Lowe," he mused. "I can't yet put my finger on what makes him different."
"Strikes me as being fairly low down the totem pole."
"I don't think so," said Bell. "He conducts himself with pride, like a man who has a mission."
"It's an up-and-down world for the New York gangs," said Harry Warren, and the handful of Van Dorn detectives who kept track of them nodded solemnly. "One day they're high and mighty, next they're in the gutter."
The back room of the Knickerbocker headquarters was gray with cigar and cigarette smoke. A bottle of whiskey Isaac Bell had bought was making the rounds.
"Who is in the gutter currently?" he asked. "The Hudson Dusters, the Marginals, and the Pearl Buttons. The Eastmans are in trouble, what with Monk Eastman at Sing Sing, and making it worse for themselves by continuing to feud with the Five Pointers."
"They had a wonderful shootout under the 3rd Avenue L the other night," remarked a detective.
"No one killed, unfortunately." "In Chinatown," Harry continued, "the Hip Sing are clawing ahead of the On Longs. On the west side, Tommy Thompson's gophers are riding high. Or were. The sons of bitches have their hands full since you sicked the railroad police on them for ambushing little Eddie Tobin."
This was met by enthusiastic nods and a remark in grudging admiration. "Those western cinder dicks are about the worst bastards I ever seen.
They've got the gophers so discombobulated that the Hip Sing Tong opened a new opium den right in the middle of gopher gang territory."
"Not so fast," Harry Warren cautioned. "I saw gophers in a Hip Sing joint downtown. Where Scully was, Isaac? I got a feeling that something was up between the Hip Sing and gophers. Maybe Scully did too."
A few muttered agreement. They'd heard rumors.
"But none of you can tell me anything about Lewis Lowe."
"That doesn't mean much, Isaac. Chinatown criminals are just plain more secretive.
And better organized, not to mention smarter.
And hooked up to Chinatowns throughout the United States and Asia."
"The international connection is intriguing, this being a spy case," Bell admitted. "Except for one big thing. Why send 2 men from New York all the way across the continent when they could have used local San Francisco Chinatown men who knew the territory?"
No one answered. The detective sat in uncomfortable silence, broken only by the clink of glass and the scrape of a match. Bell looked around the room at Harry's team of veterans. He missed John Scully. Scully had been a wizard in a brain session.
"Why the whole charade on the train?" he demanded. "It doesn't make sense."
More silence ensued.
Bell asked, "How's little Eddie doing?"
"Still touch and go.
Tell him I'll get up there soon as I can for a visit. Doubt he'll know you're in the room."
Harry Warren said, "That's another weird thing as far as I'm concerned. Why would the gophers go out on a limb to fire up Van Dorn's against them?"
"They're stupid," a detective answered, and everyone laughed. "But not that stupid. Like Isaac says about Lewis Lowe crossing the continent, beating up the kid didn't make sense. The gangs don't pick fights outside their circle."
Isaac Bell said, "You told me it was strange that the Iceman went to Camden." Harry nodded vigorously.
"Gophers don't leave home."
"And you said that gophers don't send warning messages or take revenge that will bring down the wrath of outsiders. Is it possible that the spy paid them to take revenge, just like he paid killers to go to Camden?"
"Who the hell knows how spies think?"
"I know someone who does," said Bell. Commander Abington Westlake sauntered out of the Harvard Club, where he had wrangled a free honorary membership, and signaled for a cab with a languid wave. A red Darak gasoline taxi zipped past a man hailing it outside the New York Yacht Club and stopped for the portly Englishman.
"Hey, that's my cab!"
"Apparently not," Abington Westlake drawled as he stepped into the Darak. "Smartly now, driver, before that disgruntled yachtsman catches up." The cab sped off. Abington Westlake gave an upper Fifth Avenue address and settled in for the ride. At 59th, the cab suddenly swerved into Central Park. He rapped his stick on the window.
"No, no, no, I'm not some tourist you take around the park. If I wanted to drive out of my way through the park, I would have instructed you to go out of the way through the park. Return to Fifth Avenue immediately."
The driver slammed on the brakes, throwing Abington Westlake off his seat. When he recovered, he found himself glaring into cold eyes of a grim-visaged Isaac Bell.
"I warn you, Bell. I have friends who will come to my aid. I will not deliver a well-deserved punch in your nose for selling me down the river to Yamamoto Kenta if you answer a question."
"Was that you who killed Yamamoto?" the English spy asked fearfully. "He died in Washington. I was in New York."
"Did you order his death?"
"I am not one of you," said Bell.
"What is your question?"
"Whoever this freelance spy is, I believe he is acting strangely. Look at this." He showed Abington Westlake the note. "He left this on the body of my detective."
"Why would he do such a thing?"
The Englishman read it in a glance.
"Appears to be sending you a message."
"Would you?"
"One does not indulge in childish exercises."
"Would you kill my man for revenge?"
"One does not indulge in the luxury of revenge."
"Would you do it as a threat, believing it would stop me?"
"He should have killed you. That would put a stop to it."
"Would you?" Abington Westlake smiled.
"I would suggest that successful spies are invisible spies. Ideally, one copies a secret plan rather than stealing it, so one's enemy never knows that his secret was stolen. Similarly, if an enemy must die, it should seem to be an accident. Falling debris at a worksite might crush a man without raising suspicion. A hatpin piercing his brain is a red flag."
"The hatpin was not in the newspapers," Bell said coldly.
"One reads between the lines," the Englishman retorted. "As I told you at the Knickerbocker, welcome to the world of espionage, Mr. Bell. You've learned a lot already. You know in your gut that the freelance spy is not first and foremost a spy."
"He doesn't think like a spy," said Bell. "He thinks like a gangster."
"Then who better to catch a gangster than a detective? Good day, sir. May I wish you happy hunting?"
He climbed out of the cab and walked toward Fifth Avenue.
Bell hurried back to the Hotel Knickerbocker and corralled Archie Abbott.
"Get up to the Newport Torpedo Factory."
"The Boston boys are already."
"I want you. I'm getting a strange feeling about that attack."
"What kind of feeling?"
"What if it wasn't sabotage? What if it was a robbery? Stay there until you discover what they took." He walked Archie to the train at Grand Central and returned to the office deep in thought. Abington Westlake had confirmed his suspicions. The spy was first and foremost a gangster, but he couldn't be Commodore Tommy. The gopher had lived and fought within the narrow confines of Hell's Kitchen his whole life. The answer must lie with Lewis Lowe. He could be the Tong. He could even be the spy. Perhaps that was what he had noticed was different about Lewis. He acted like he had a purpose. It was time to put the question to him.
Bell collected Lewis Lowe from the Brooklyn Navy Yard brig late at night and handcuffed his wrists behind his back. Lowe's first surprise came when, instead of putting him in a truck or an auto, Bell walked him toward the river. They waited at the water's edge.
Hull 44 loomed behind them. The wind carried the sounds of ship engines, slatting sails, whistles, and horns. Blacked out but for running lights, Lowell Falconer's turbine yacht Dyname approached in near silence. Deckhands guided Bell and his prisoner aboard without speaking a word. The yacht backed into the river and headed downstream. It went under the Brooklyn Bridge and passed the battery and picked up speed on the upper bay.
"If you're planning to throw me overboard," Lewis Lowe said, "remember, I know how to swim."
"Wearing those manacles?"
"I assumed you would remove them, being above torture."
The helmsman increased speed to 30 knots. Bell took Lowe into the darkened cabin where they sat in silence, sheltered from the wind and spray. Dyname crossed the lower bay. Bell saw the light ship flash by the porthole. When Dyname's bow rose to the first Atlantic comber, Lewis Lowe asked,
"Where are you taking me?"
"To sea."
"How far to sea?"
"About 50 miles.
"That will take all night."
"Not on this ship." The helmsman opened her up. An hour passed. The turbines slowed and the yacht settled down. Suddenly it bumped hard against something and stopped. Bell took Lewis's arm, checked that he hadn't jimmied open the cuffs, and led him out on deck. Silent deckhands helped them onto the wooden deck of a barge. Then Dyname wheeled about and raced off. In minutes, all to be seen of her was the fiery discharge from her stack, and soon she vanished into the night.
"Now what?" asked Lewis Lowe.
Creamy white caps shone in the starlight. The barge rolled with the movement of the sea. "Now we climb."
"Climb? Climb what?"
"This mast." Bell directed Lewis's gaze up the cage mast. The airy structure rose so high that its swaying top seemed to brush the stars.
"What is this? Where are we?"
"We're on a target barge anchored in the U.S. Navy Atlantic firing range. Test engineers have erected on the barge this 125-foot cage mast, the latest development in dreadnought spotting masts." Bell climbed two rungs, unlocked Lewis's right cuff, and locked it around his own ankle. "Ready? Here we go."
"Where?"
"Up these ladders. When I raise my leg, you raise your arm."
"Why?"
"There's a test scheduled for dawn to see how the cage mast fares in battle conditions when bombarded by 12-inch guns. Any spy worth his salt would give his eye teeth to watch. Let's go." It was a long climb to the spotting top, but neither man was breathing hard when they reached the platform.
"You are in excellent condition, Lewis."
Bell removed the cuff from his ankle and locked it to the tubing that formed the mast.
"Now what?"
"Wait for dawn." A cold wind sprang up. The mast swayed as it sighed around the tubing. At first light, the silhouette of a battleship took shape on the horizon.
"New Hampshire," said Bell.
"You recognize her, I'm sure, by her three funnels and old-fashioned ram bow. You will recall that she carries 7- and 8-inch guns in addition to 4 12s. Any minute now." The battleship emitted a red flash. A 500-pound shell roared past like a freight train. Lewis ducked.
"What?"
he screamed.
"What?"
Now the sound of the gun rumbled their way. Another flash. Another shell roared closer.
"They'll have the range soon,"
Bell told Lewis Lowe. The 12-inch gun flashed red. A shell struck in a shower of sparks 50 feet below. The mast shook. Lewis Lowe cried,
"You're a madman!"
"They say this helix design is remarkably strong," Bell replied. More shells roared by. When another hit, Lewis covered his face. Soon there was enough light in the sky for Bell to read his gold watch. A few more single shots. Then they're scheduled to blast salvos, before they finish up with full broadsides.
"All right, all right. I admit I am Tong."
"You're more than Tong," Isaac Bell replied coldly. he was rewarded by an expression of surprise on Lewis's ordinarily immobile face.
What do you mean?
Sun Tzu on the Art of War. If I may quote your countrymen, be so subtle that you are invisible.
I don't know what you mean.
You told me on the train they think we're all opium addicts or Tong gangsters. You sounded like a man with a broader point of view. Who are you really? A salvo thundered. Two shells ripped through the structure. Still it stood, but it was swinging side to side.
I am not Tong.
You just told me you are. Which is it?
I am not a gangster.
Stop telling me what you aren't and start telling me what you are.
I am Tong Menghui.
What is Tong Menghui?
Chinese Revolutionary Alliance. We are a secret resistance movement. We pledge our lives to revive Chinese society.
Explain, said Isaac Bell. In a rush of words, Lewis Lowe admitted that he was a fervent Chinese nationalist plotting to overthrow the corrupt empress.
She is strangling China. England, Germany, all Europe, even the U.S., feed on China's dying body.
If you are a revolutionist, what are you doing in America?
Dreadnought battleships. China must build a modern fleet to fend off colonial invaders.
By blowing up the Great White Fleet in San Francisco?
That wasn't for China. That was for him.
Him? Who are you talking about? With a fearful glance at the New Hampshire, Lowe said,
There is a man, a spy, who pays. Not in money, but in valuable information about other nations' dreadnoughts. We, Harold Wing and me, pass it along to Chinese naval architects.
And you pay for it by doing his bidding.
Exactly, sir. Can we go down now?
Bell knew this was a major breakthrough in the case. This was the freelance who Yamamoto had tried to betray in exchange for a clean escape. Lewis had gotten him close again. You are working for three masters. The Chinese Navy, your Tong Menghui resistance movement, and the spy who paid you to attack the magazine at Mare Island. Who is he? Another freight train of a shell roared by. The structure trembled.
I don't know who he is.
Who is your intermediary? How does he give you orders and information?
Mailboxes. He sent information, orders, and money for expenses in mailboxes.
Lo ducked another shell.
Please, let us go down.
Across the water, sparkling in the first rays of sunlight, all the New Hampshire's guns traversed toward the cage mast. Here comes a broadside, said Bell.
You must believe me.
Bell said, I feel a certain affection for you, Lewis. You held off shooting me until I jumped from the train. Lewis Lowe stared at the battleship.
I was not sparing your life. I didn't have the guts to pull the trigger.
I'm tempted to let you down, Lewis, but you haven't told me all you know. I don't believe that everything came in the mail. Lewis Lowe cast another fearful gaze at the white battleship and broke down completely.
It was Commodore Tommy Thompson who told us to attack the magazine at Mare Island.
How did you hook up with the Gopher Gang?
The spy bribed the Hip Sing to allow us to approach Commodore Tommy Thompson in their name, pretending we were Tong.
Bell handed Lewis Lowe a snowy white handkerchief. Wave this. He led Lowe down the mast. When they reached the barge, apoplectic test range officers raced up in a boat.
How did you...
Thought you'd never stop shooting. We were getting hungry up there. I don't believe for a moment that Commodore Tommy is the spy, Isaac Bell told Joseph Van Dorn. But I'm willing to bet Tommy's got a good idea who he is.
He better, said Van Dorn.
Raiding his territory is costing a carload of money for the cops and some very expensive favors to keep Tammany Hall from protesting.
The tall detective and his broad-chested boss were overseeing preparations for the raid from inside a Marmon parked across from Commodore Tommy's saloon on West 39th Street. "But the railroads will love us," said Bell, and the boss conceded that several rail tycoons had already thanked him personally for cutting back the worst depredations of the Gopher Gang. "Looking at the bright side, after this the spy's ring will be a lot smaller."
"I'm not counting on that," said Isaac Bell, mindful of learning about the explosion at the Newport Torpedo Factory while on the train to San Francisco. A dozen railroad cops led the attack, battering down the saloon door, breaking up the furniture, smashing bottles, and staving in beer kegs. Shots rang within. Harry Warren's boys, standing by with handcuffs, marched a dozen gophers into a police department paddy wagon.
"Tommy's holed up in the cellar with a bullet hole in his arm," Harry reported to Bell and Van Dorn. "He's all alone. He may listen to reason."
Bell went first, down wooden steps into a damp cellar. Tommy Thompson was slumped in a chair like a mountain brought low by an earthquake. He had a pistol in his hand. He opened his eyes, looked up blearily at Bell's weapon pointed at his head, and let his pistol fall to the earthen floor.
"I'm Isaac Bell."
"What's wrong with the Van Dorns?"
Tommy was indignant.
"It's always been live and let live. Pay the cops, stay out of each other's business. We got a whole system at work here, and a bunch of private dicks screw it up."
"Is that why you put one of my boys in the hospital?" Bell asked coldly.
"That wasn't my idea,"
Tommy protested.
"Wasn't your idea," Bell retorted. "Who ramrods the gophers?"
"It weren't my idea,"
Tommy repeated sullenly.
"You're asking me to believe that the famous Commodore Tommy Thompson, who's killed off every rival to command the toughest gang in New York, takes orders from someone else?"
Resentment boiled behind Tommy's tough facade. Bell played on it, laughing.
"Maybe you are telling the truth. Maybe you are just a saloon keeper."
"God damn it!"
Tommy Thompson erupted. He tried to get out of the chair. The tall detective restrained him with a warning gesture.
"Commodore Tommy don't take orders from no one."
Bell called out, and Harry Warren and two of his men trooped down the stairs. "Tommy says it wasn't his idea to beat up little Eddie Tobin. Some fella made him do it."
"Some fellow?" Harry echoed scornfully. "Did this some fellow who ordered you to beat up a Van Dorn happen to be the same fellow who ordered you to send Lewis Lowe and Harold Wing to blow up the magazine at Mare Island?"
"He didn't order me. He paid me. There's a difference."
"Who?" Bell demanded.
"Bastard left me to stick around and face the music."
"Who?"
"Goddamned Eyes O'Shea. That's who."
"Eyes O'Shea?" Harry Warren echoed incredulously. "You take us for jackasses? Eyes O'Shea is dead 15 years.
"No, he ain't."
"Harry," Bell snapped, "who is Eyes O'Shea?"
"Gopher kid years ago. Vicious piece of work.
A comer till he disappeared."
"I heard talk he was back," muttered one of Harry's detectives. "I didn't believe it."
"I still don't."
"I do," said Isaac Bell. "The spy's been acting like a gangster all along."